up next. Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, featuring unique shopping and the historic Jack's Cafe, featuring an eclectic menu. A Kenosha tradition since 1911. Modernized for a new age. Visit jackandrea.com for more information.
And we welcome you to the morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am very excited to be sitting opposite a faculty colleague today on the morning show by the name of Eric Johnson, who is assistant professor of economics at Carthage. So he would, for instance, be a fairly close colleague to Dr. Art Sear, who's a frequent guest on the morning show. And our conversation today dovetails nicely from an interview that aired a week ago today, last Monday. I aired my interview with the author of a book called The Splendid Exchange, How Trade Changed the World. An illuminating look at how the whole notion of trade and commerce was one of the most powerful, in some ways maybe the most powerful force in shaping the rise of civilization. And the way in which the human race has occupied this planet and the world that we know today, so much of it is tied up in the business of trade in ways that most of us do not begin to understand, let alone appreciate. So that book, The Splendid Exchange, was at least for me a really fascinating exploration of something I knew very, very little about. Professor Eric Johnson today comes to us as someone who is an expert in trade, and we're going to be focusing most of our time and this conversation on the rather turbulent trade relationship that the United States has at the moment with the nation of China, and about the Phase One trade agreement that was just signed a couple of weeks ago, and what that might mean for the future, and what does it address in terms of our current impasse with China? What does it fail to address? And is the situation likely to become better between our two nations? Or are we destined to have a long, protracted, and painful trade war with China? A little bit later in the hour, we're going to spend a few minutes talking with Professor Johnson about the course that he just finished teaching at Carthage for J-Term, a course called The Economics of Beer. And we will find out what is behind that intriguing title. But first, more serious matters with this trade war with China. And Professor Eric Johnson, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here. Before we talk about our topic, since this is your initial visit to the morning show, I thought it would be interesting for our listeners to hear a little bit about where you come from originally, and also a little bit about what drew you to the particular academic field in which you're devoting all your time and energy, or most of your time and energy.
Well, I grew up in Minnesota, in about a stone's throw from two different power plants, actually, from a nuclear power plant and coal-fired power plant. And my dad was a small businessman, so we talked about economics at lunch and dinner and breakfast, and long before I knew anything what was going on with it. And so I think I was destined to become an economist in some way. And my specialty in graduate school was all about thinking about energy and pollution in the environment, and focused on electricity, in part, I think, because I had two very large smokestacks next to my house.
Yeah, right.
And so I learned a lot about how electricity markets work and the pollution from electricity generation, and how nuclear and coal fit into a mix with new renewables. And then expanding on that, thinking about how electricity and trade patterns fit around the world, and how production in China affects consumption in the U.S., and how pollution kind of moves across borders in our phones and in all of our electronics and everything else that that gets made other places.
Mm. Yeah, it's an interconnected world in which we live, and more so. In fact, it occurs to me that in some ways the work that someone like you would have done 50, 60 years ago might be rather different from the world you have to describe to your students now.
Most definitely, most definitely. There's a lot of different concerns. 60 years ago, we were very much concerned about local pollution, that we had rivers on fire and we had smog that we couldn't see more than a couple hundred yards in front of us, in Southern California particularly. And, you know, there's a whole wave of environmental legislation that was passed in the 60s to deal with a lot of those problems. And now we have an entirely new wave of problems to deal with that are much more global in nature and therefore much, much more difficult to solve.
Right. And I guess that's two things that we're talking about there. Is we're talking about truly global issues, global problems. They are not isolated in terms of the harm that exists. And then the nature of how these problems can be addressed, if they can be addressed, must be on a global scale. And mm-hmm. so it's the problems are global in scope, and the solutions must be comparably global in scope. And that's no small matter.
No, not at all. It's one of those things that it feels less useful for the U.S. to reduce their carbon emissions if China's not reducing theirs and the EU's not reducing theirs. And so you all have to get together and agree on something, lest you feel like you're the only one contributing to the work.
So. Right. And it is the planet that we all share. So
yes.
One hopes we can get to the same page and sooner rather than later to begin even more serious work on these issues. Today, of course, we're going to be talking more specifically about the United States and its relationship right now with China, and kind of the turbulence that there has been there, which is not going to be news to anybody listening. And then we'll talk about what's kind of ahead. Ahead of us talking really specifically about China, I wonder if you could maybe just describe to us in a much more general way who the United States trades with. Who are our most significant trading partners? I mean, do we essentially trade with just about everybody, and does just about everybody send things to us? I mean, what are the sort of primary channels of trade at the moment, and where does China fit into that, I assume, rather complex picture?
Well, you're right. It's a very complex picture. Your car has surely been made in about 20 different countries. But the U.S. largest trading partners are the Canada-Mexico. That was pushed about as even a stronger relationship through NAFTA in 1994, and also very, very strong and large trading relationship with the EU. And then China, Japan, and South Korea, collectively those groups of countries account for probably about 75% of trade with the U.S. And we trade lots of things back and forth. We send finished products to China. We receive raw materials and intermediate products, so components to consumer products, and vice versa. We send components to finished products to China, and they finish them. And so it's a very complex web. And autos are kind of a great example of this, because there's so many different pieces, and there's a whole host of firms that make a catalytic converter or a seat for your car or a steering wheel. And all of those things are made separately, likely by very different companies, likely across many different borders. And the auto industry was one of the first industries to adopt what's called just-in-time receiving, that your components appear just when you need them, so you don't have to keep a large inventory on hand, which is helpful until trade flows start to get disrupted and it's harder to get goods across borders and things like that. And so the trade disputes with Canada and Mexico in particular recently have had some negative impacts on the auto industry because of this just-in-time manufacturing.
So explain again in general, before we dig into the specifics with China, what are the sort of regulatory boundaries that guide trade and the way we function with our trading partners? It sounds like someone can't just send a boat over loaded with stuff that just gets dumped off and then brought to stores. There is something, in a sense, controlling, probably to a limited extent, mm-hmm. what flows out, what flows in, and what happens to it when it gets here.
Yep. So Customs and Border Patrol are the is the agency tasked with monitoring trade in the United States. When you fly on a plane from across the border or drive across the border from Canada, they'll ask you if you have anything to declare. If you're an importer, it's just on a much larger scale. You have to tell them everything that you're bringing into the country. And some sets of goods, depending on which country you're coming from, have tariffs or taxes associated with them. And so the entire global trading order is essentially organized under the umbrella of the World Trade Organization. So this is a set of most countries in the world that have agreed to a standard set of rules of how trade should work. And the idea being that trade makes everyone richer. And that's not necessarily uniformly, but we can make nations richer. And then there's a distributional aspect inside of nations. So we might see a decline in manufacturing in the U.S., but separately we might see an increase in services being produced in the U.S. And so each country has to figure out how to deal with that change in production within their country. But the World Trade Organization sets up rules such that every country ought to not favor any other country that's part of the World Trade Organization. So they should essentially shop around for the cheapest products they can find. They shouldn't buy very expensive soybeans from the U.S. when they can buy soybeans from Brazil for half the price, unless there's a significant quality difference for some reason, that the products are actually different. And this is the system that's underlied global trade since 1990s and before that. There was the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, which was a very similar mechanism. And the World Trade Organization rules have been modified and amended many times since its foundation. But that is the global trading order that has been in place for more or less the last 60 years. The Trump administration has started to back away from those international multilateral institutions and taken a very transactional approach of we will make a trade deal with one country, we'll make a different trade deal with another country, instead of trying to amend the global trade rules that affect everyone equally.
Interesting. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Eric Johnson, Assistant Professor of Economics at Carthage College, and we are talking for most of this hour about trade and now very specifically about the relationship between the United States and China. So things have, of course, been turbulent between the U.S. and China and for some time, and especially so more recently as we've engaged in what a lot of people are calling a trade war of sorts. Give us some context about what has gone wrong between our two nations in this respect and whether or not it, at the heart of it is some sort of disregard for this regulatory system with the World Trade Organization that you were just describing. Aren't those regulations supposed to guard against these kind of disputes?
Right. So the World Trade Organization was set up largely as a club of economies that were largely capitalist-based and therefore took a set of assumptions as true in every country. So there was private industry running the entire economy. Businesses were making decisions that would minimize their costs or make them as much money as possible. And the system worked reasonably well. As I said, it has been amended. There's lots of rules about how or if governments can subsidize firms or particular industries. The U.S. and EU have been in a trade dispute for about 20 years between around Boeing and Airbus and subsidies that those companies receive through either the EU fiscal authority or through the U.S. federal government. And there was most recently a filing on behalf of in favor of the U.S. that Airbus was unfairly being subsidized by the EU. The EU has a countervailing case that's likely to be reach a decision in about 2 years, 1 or 2 years, that will likely rule against the U.S., that the U.S. is illegally subsidizing Boeing. In response to that decision, the Trump administration was then allowed to impose what are called retaliatory tariffs, that we can put tariffs on European goods to effectively encourage them to stop subsidizing Airbus, and that the U.S. can recoup some of those economic losses is the idea. And so oftentimes those tariffs are chosen very carefully with political motivations in mind. So the retaliatory tariffs for Airbus that were approved under the WTO were largely put on French wine and scotch and things not necessarily at all related to the aircraft industry, but that would have political pressure on those who control tariffs.
Right. And help us understand the nuts and bolts of how that kind of a tariff works. So, for instance, French wine. So what are we talking about in terms of the implementation of something like that? And for someone who enjoys drinking French wine and purchasing French wine, what does it mean for them?
Right. So like I said, it's not too much different than filling out a form when you cross the border. Is if you import French wine into the U.S., you take delivery of your crate of French wine or probably many, many gallons of French wine at the border. And at that point, you declare to the Customs and Border Patrol, I have X number of cases of French wine, and they look up on it in a very – well, now electronic book, what the tariff rate is on that, and you then tariff is just a tax. So then they say, well, this is $100,000 worth of wine. The tariff is 10%, and therefore you owe us $10,000 in taxes in order to get your French wine into the U.S.
So like right in that moment.
In that moment, yes.
So they cough up in whatever form and pay that tariff before it can cross our border.
That's right. So then your liquor store paid probably about 10% more for their French wine than they did before the tariffs, and therefore will charge you about 10% more. So the tariffs are actually a tax on domestic consumers that I just simply pay more because I want my French wine. And it hurts the French wine industry essentially by lowering demand in the U.S. for French wine. People just buy a little bit less. Maybe they'll buy Chilean wine or Argentinian wine because French wine is relatively more expensive now.
Right.
But it's actually paid for out of our pocketbooks, not out of anyone in France.
Interesting. So even though the intent of something like that is to direct pain, create pain among, not just French wine developers, but France in general, and the leaders of France would feel that pain at least secondhand, and perhaps change their ways. But that is pain that's also experienced here on the consumer level.
Yep, that's right.
So that means when one imposes tariffs, you need to think about the pain that you are inflicting not only on the receiving end, but in a sense, on the delivering end over here.
That's right. Yep.
Wow. So what was the impasse involving the United States and China? What kind of practices was China engaged in that we found objectionable?
So China joined the World Trade Organization in 2000. And as I said, that was a set of assumptions that kind of underlied the World Trade Organization, the WTO, is that it was all the countries were largely capitalist economies, and this applied much less to China than it did to many of the other countries. So as part of their agreement to join the WTO, they promised to change some of their industrial structure and change how their economy worked so that they could gain access with lower tariffs to all of these global markets. And
ahead of that, what was trade like with China before they became part of the World Trade Organization?
There was certainly a fair amount of trade, but lots of countries, in the United States included, had relatively high tariffs on Chinese products. Mm. And so joining the World Trade Organization meant that everyone in the World Trade Organization would have then lower tariffs on Chinese products. That was the benefit China saw in joining.
Gotcha. So what has happened since China joined, and has something happened recently to kind of change the situation and our feelings about China in this respect?
So in many ways, nothing has changed about our feelings toward China. Since they joined the WTO, every administration in the U.S. has had a similar set of complaints that many of their firms were subsidized by the Chinese central government and that there was rules and some illegal transfer of technology in order to gain access to the Chinese market. And every administration from George H.W. Bush through President Trump have had these similar sets of complaints. And every administration before the Trump administration had decided to try to work in international coalitions to change China's behavior. President Trump was elected to office in part with the idea of reviving U.S. manufacturing and what he saw was, and every other administration had saw, was somewhat unfair practices with Chinese manufacturing, except he chose to take a different policy path and impose unilateral tariffs. So he thought imposing a certain amount of economic pain on China through tariffs on Chinese goods in the U.S. would cause them to change their behavior.
Just before we talk about that, what was the practice before? You mentioned coalitions. So what was that tactic about, and why was it, I presume, not particularly successful?
So the previous strategies by most administrations, with some deviations, were to form a block of trading partners. So largely the EU, Australia, the US, of course, Canada, Mexico, South Korea, Japan, and gain a certain amount of international pressure to continue to pressure them through negotiation largely of, we have these threats, but we're going to all work together because we know you trade with all of us, not just one. And so we have more pressure together than by ourselves. So none of those countries were willing, or at least at this point, had been willing to impose very large tariffs on Chinese goods. And so that was what the Trump administration decided to do is, well, we don't need to work with these other countries. The U.S. is a sufficiently large market that we can bend them to our will by ourselves. Mm.
So remind our listeners about what transpired in terms of, at least roughly, and roughly is probably a good word in a couple of different respects because it has been pretty rough between our two nations. What was the first step that the Trump administration took in this regard, and what response came in its wake?
Right. So the Trump administration threatened tariffs because they said they had these very familiar complaints of subsidies to Chinese firms, as well as these transfers of intellectual property. And they said, if you don't change this now, in a relatively short time period, we will impose large tariffs, and we will keep imposing more tariffs until you effectively change your economic model of state-owned enterprises within China. And so starting in about 2018, the first round of tariffs were imposed on Chinese goods, and under WTO rules, he invoked a particular section of WTO rules that said, I'm allowed to do this. China then responded in kind and said, if you would like to put tariffs on our goods, we will be happy to put some tariffs on your goods. And as I said, tariffs are very politically calculated oftentimes. And so the first tariffs China put on U.S. goods were for Harley-Davidson's and for Kentucky bourbon. So you might think these are strange things to put tariffs on until you realize that now ex-representative Paul Ryan was the home congressman for Harley-Davidson in the Milwaukee area. And Senator Mitch McConnell is from Kentucky. And so there was political pressure being put on by those tariffs, not trade pressure.
So it was very much targeted choices with specifically Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell in mind.
Correct.
Fascinating. I've not heard anybody point that out before, or I'm sure somebody has someplace, but I'm certainly learning that for the very first time. And remind me about the extent of these tariffs. And is that also something that is, in a sense, limited by the WTO in terms of how much, how high a tariff you can impose?
Well, I think we're largely operating outside WTO rules now. The section that of the WTO agreement that the Trump administration declared they were going to impose tariffs under was about national security. And so they're effectively, they said, we are allowed to impose tariffs however we see fit. And so we're not really dealing within WTO rules for our trade with China anymore.
So how significant have these tariffs been? I mean, what kind of numbers are we talking about, at least roughly?
So the average tariff on Chinese goods prior to 2018 was about 3%. It's now about 21%. So that's over a fivefold increase in the tariff rate. About two-thirds of U.S. imports from China are subject to tariffs. So that means about two-thirds of the things we import from China have some tariffs, on average 20%, 21% tariff rate on it. So that means prices have gone up approximately 21%.
Wow. What are the goods that are most significant in terms of what we import from China?
So we import what economists call a lot of intermediate goods. So these are things that you and I don't buy, but that are components in our electronics, or perhaps textiles that are then finished into final shirts in the U.S. or something like that. The Trump administration has been very careful to largely keep consumer goods out of the realm of tariffs for now because I suspect they believe that there would be more consumer backlash if I saw the price of my iPhone going up, that I could point directly to this tariff on iPhones as opposed to some chip in there just simply got more expensive for some reason.
Interesting. So in a sense, the pain of this is not felt so much at the consumer level, but in sort of another layer of our economy, which is not to minimize it, but it's the kind of pain that we, just ordinary citizens, tend not to feel ourselves.
The pain is less obvious. I think the pain is actually felt by us. Because every firm says, well, I need this component. The price went up by 10%, and so I have to charge 10% more for my product. And so almost all of those tariffs get passed along in final goods prices, but there's not there's the iPhone tariff or there's the computer tariff that I can point to. It's a tariff of stuff in the middle, which just makes a little bit less transparent.
Right. There's kind of a middleman.
That's right. That's right.
Or several middlemen, maybe. So what can you tell us about what effect this has had in terms of amount of goods? I mean, are we ordering a lot less? Are they ordering a lot less or taking in a lot less? What kind of effect on that, in that respect, has this had?
So trade has shrunk quite a bit with China. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head for the details.
Sure.
However, for instance, agricultural exports have gone down by about 50% to China in the last 2 years, for soybeans particularly.
Right. I should mention that just this morning as we are recording this on February 3rd, NPR had a really interesting story. They're actually were anchored in Iowa ahead of the caucuses there, and they had a couple of very interesting interviews with Iowa farmers who have felt this pain very, very acutely. And it has had a very, very uncomfortable impact, needless to say.
And again, with the kind of politically targeted tariffs, China has chosen agricultural products again as rural America is seen as Trump's base of support. And so if they can turn his base against them, perhaps the tariffs will go away as well. And so they have targeted agricultural commodities for that very reason.
Interesting. One thing I kind of wondered about is why is it that this is so much about soybeans? Is it that China consumes an enormous amount of soybeans, and are they unable to raise soybeans themselves?
So the two largest cash crops, or two of the largest cash crops in the U.S. are corn and soybeans. And so that is one of the obvious places to target. They are much easier to export than swine, for instance. And so China is a very large consumer of soybeans, both in terms of human consumption as well as pig consumption in China. And so they have a very, very large global demand for soybeans. And so it was, again, an easy place to target in part.
Right. And I know that one of the Iowa farmers that was interviewed by NPR talked about how at the moment they are lucky if they can even break even in terms of raising soybeans right now.
I mean, they are
not making any money at all. And probably in many cases, farmers are losing money raising soybeans, which is sad to see, obviously.
Right. Very much so. You know, they are certainly the collateral damage you were talking about from this trade war. They're the suppliers that are getting hurt in the U.S., whereas consumers of soybeans in China are also then getting hurt.
Right. So you were telling me that an agreement of sorts was signed in the middle of January between the United States and China. Tell us what that was, and is it just the start of something even more significant, and what kind of a difference do you see it making?
So certainly the global hope is that it's the start of something more significant. It was labeled the Phase 1 agreement, implying there was at least a Phase 2. So the agreement was largely to stop escalating tariffs. So there's been approximately four phases of each country raising tariffs or expanding the set of goods that tariffs apply to or higher tariffs apply to. And so the agreement stopped the increase in tariffs, but likely also cements a new normal of we will be having these reasonably large tariffs and China will have these reasonably large tariffs for the foreseeable future. So the agreement was in part, we're going to stop raising our tariffs for now. So you could think of it as a little bit of a truce. And it had kind of three large components. One component was China would agree to buy $200 billion of particular sets of products. So agricultural products, energy products, manufactured products, and services. And so China would agree to buy all of these things from the U.S., which we can return to in a minute how likely that is to actually happen. And they were then also agreed to essentially internationally recognize the commercial reforms that they have undertaken within China to solidify some more intellectual property rights, as well as changing how the People's Bank works in terms of currency purchases and changing the exchange rates. And so those last two parts are largely seen internationally as very minor parts of this agreement because these were things that China was already doing without the agreement. So the agreement largely...
Or should have been doing? Or were they doing?
They had done in the previous 2 years. So you might argue some of those reforms were in part because of the trade war, but then they were codified through this Phase 1 agreement as we commit to continue to do these things. And so the agricultural purchases and energy purchases were seen as the thing that President Trump held up as the success, that there will be X number more soybeans being purchased from the U.S. and X amount energy more being purchased from the U.S. over the 2020 and 2021 time period. I think many people cynically see this as an agreement that can't be reached. It's unlikely that U.S. farmers, for instance, can produce enough soybeans to export to China to meet the goal that China said they would purchase. But it won't be verified until the end of 2021, after the election season, of course.
So this is well-timed in that respect, isn't it?
The general suspicion is that the Chinese also decided that we are happy to kick the can down the road and see what happens after the election. We might be dealing with a new administration that might have a different policy toward us as well. The U.S. or China at any point in the agreement can say, we don't believe the other side is holding up their side of the bargain, either in terms of commodity purchases or domestic policy in terms of intellectual property and whatnot, and reimpose tariffs. Mm. And so the idea is, I believe, is that this looks like a victory for both sides in part. International agreements always need to look like victories for both sides. And may deliver some benefits, but the U.S. also has the ability to say, well, you clearly will not be meeting your agreement, in part because perhaps it's not attainable for U.S. farmers. As you mentioned, U.S. farmers could certainly ramp up their soy production, possibly even to a level that would meet the commitments under the agreement. But it also seems somewhat unlikely that because the U.S. can pull out of this agreement at any point, if I were a soybean farmer, I wouldn't necessarily want to be stuck holding that ball in case the policy changes all of a sudden and my soybeans aren't going to be purchased anymore in the way I thought they were.
Yeah, that feels like a risky move. I mean, you're betting on something that feels very shaky.
Right.
In some respects, at least.
And so part of the goal, I should say, of the World Trade Organization is to set up a certain amount of stability in international trade that firms can be certain that this is the system we're playing under. And so if I don't know if the U.S. is going to pull out of this agreement or if China is going to be deemed not in compliance with the agreement such that we will pull out, then I maybe am unwilling to risk my farm, quite literally, on the policies still being there.
Right. This makes the phrase bet the farm mean something very different and kind of ominous. You had said, I think actually before we went on the air, that there are a number of things that this Phase One trade agreement signed in mid-January does not do. And probably the biggest thing is that it doesn't really have anything to do with some of the most fundamental changes that we would want to see happen in China in terms of how their economy functions. What is it that we would want to see happen, which is not likely to happen anytime soon, at least, and has nothing really to do with this particular agreement we're talking about now?
Right. So this agreement pauses the trade war, commits to purchasing American products, again, probably from sets that President Trump sees as constituencies he needs to please. But the original complaint was about intellectual property and, even more importantly, subsidies to Chinese domestic firms. This agreement doesn't do anything about either of those two issues, largely. And so it kind of partially solves the problem that was introduced by the trade war, but it doesn't solve the problems that caused the trade war. Mm. So the phase two, which these are admittedly the much more difficult issues that American administrations have been working on for 20 years with the Chinese government, it doesn't solve those. And so phase two, in theory, will be addressing some of those things, but those are very structural issues to how China's economy works and figuring out kind of how large subsidies are to steel production or aluminum production in China is not particularly easy because a local firm maybe gets slightly cheaper loans from a local bank because the bank is tied to the central government. And so figuring out kind of the value of that subsidy is a very tricky problem.
Right.
And it's actually similar to kind of previous agreements, previous trade problems with the EU and Japan and South Korea around agricultural products. That there's a whole web of subsidies at lots of different levels, and adding those things up, coming up with a unified structure is difficult. And in part, the goal of the WTO is to have a neutral third arbiter that could effectively value what those subsidies were and put some data and facts around what that is.
It's probably important to say that China isn't the only country that has subsidies. I mean, and we do that too, right?
Yes, every country has subsidies, which is sometimes the drawback of putting too many facts around this is then you start to look in the mirror a little bit too much as well.
Right.
I will say the Chinese economic model is very different. The scale of subsidies is almost surely larger than in the EU or US.
So they are not objecting so much to any subsidizing that we are doing within our own economy.
That's correct.
So the concern is really going in the one way. So is part of this agreement that we're agreeing to buy a certain amount of goods from China?
No. No.
So it's a one-way agreement.
What we get in return is that the policy reforms they've already put into place over the last 2 years about currency purchases to keep the yuan from appreciating and the intellectual property changes that have happened over the last 2 years are codified. So that was the benefit to the U.S., the Chinese, as well as the purchases. China sees the benefit as the lowering, or the pause, I should say, of the tariffs and a slight lowering from an average of about 21% to an average of about 19%.
So that suggests that they are feeling the pain and that, at least to some extent, this strategy has been effective. I mean, is it fair to say that?
I mean, I think there's some evidence that China is absolutely feeling the pain. It's probably they're having an economic slowdown, which is surely in part due to, in large part due to factors that are not about the trade war. But that is certainly part of the calculus as well. I have no doubt about that.
Can you just say a word about that, about what else is ailing the Chinese economy? Because I think a lot of us are still stuck in a mind frame that views China as this unstoppable juggernaut. Mm-hmm. And that's just a very simplistic view, of course, of such a complicated nation, which is facing a number of different difficulties of their own. What would be a couple of the most significant issues that are, in a sense, dogging the Chinese economy right now?
Sure. So the Chinese economy has been growing at about 10% per year for a very long time, which has meant, in terms of sheer size of output, they're the largest economy in the world on a per-person basis. They're nowhere near that. But a lot of that growth you can think of as what economists sometimes call catch-up growth, that there's a lot of kind of low-hanging fruit and investment to be done in roads and bridges and airports and kind of industrializing the economy. So the U.S. experienced this 150 years ago. The EU has experienced this. Lots of economies have kind of done this catch-up and getting into technology and creating more value through intellectual property and things of that nature. And in part, the surplus of labor, if you will, of the movement from relatively inefficient farms in rural China to cities has simply started to slow down a little bit, that there's less gains to be had there. And it's certainly unreasonable to expect the U.S. economy to grow at 10%. And at some point, all economies start to slow down. And it's in part just a secular stagnation as well, that we've realized a lot of those gains already.
Well, it's going to be fascinating to see where this goes from here, and I really appreciate the background that you've shared on a complicated situation, and so thank you for all of that clarification. Let's spend our last couple of minutes talking about something that, as far as I know, is not closely related, but maybe in some respects, this J-term course you just finished teaching called The Economics of Beer. So tell us what's behind that intriguing title.
Yeah, so brewing beer is a hobby of mine, honestly, which is how I got into this class. But I see economics everywhere I look, and so I decided to teach a class that looks at a very particular industry and sees how that industry works. Alcohol is, unsurprisingly, one of the most regulated industries in the U.S. There's a if you produce alcohol, in general, you cannot distribute alcohol to liquor stores, and if you're a liquor store, you can't produce or distribute from suppliers. So there's this what's called a three-tier system, and so we spend a lot of time talking about the three-tier system, spend a lot of time imagining we are a brewery and thinking about how do we change costs, what would we have to sell this beer for if we wanted to be a commercial brewery. And of course, because it's the economics of beer, we also have some fun brewing beer in the classroom as well. So everyone gets to design their own, or each group of four students get to design their own beer and produce that beer and figure out how much that beer costs them to make.
Interesting. And of course, what's so interesting about the beer world right now is all of these small independent breweries. There's a fancier word for it that's
craft
beers. Yes. And so I suppose you explore what that's all about as well. What kind of realities does the craft brewer face?
Sure. The craft beer segment is very interesting in a lot of ways because it's sprung up over the last 20 years as probably is a very competitive industry that every town now feels like it has about five different breweries in it, and they're all competing for butts in the seats in some way. But they also feel it as a very collaborative process, that the more people that drink craft beer, they will see something that the brewers will tell you at least tastes an awful lot better than what's typically called the American lager, which is you can think of Budweiser or Miller. And so they have a very kind of different problem. We went to a local brewery in town called Arnagen that has a five-barrel beer system, and they got to see how they design their beers, how they produce their beers, and kind of their economic problem and how they are starting to distribute their beers in stores now as well. And then the next day we went up to Miller Brewing, and we saw them making 10 million gallons of beer a year and saw how that system is very much mechanized and efficient, and kind of the economic ideal of efficiency of a firm, that we're cutting costs everywhere we can, whereas the local craft industry sees themselves as part of a community. Usually the brewing and hands-on brewing is very important to the craft industry in a way.
Sure. Yeah, there's something very faceless about that huge sort of factory-produced beer versus a beer that's produced by someone who you probably regard as a friend, and again, a member of the community.
And there, to that point, the craft brewery industry employs about 50% of the employees in the brewing industry, but makes about 5% of the beer. So that will give you a sense of how few faces there are around Miller relative to each beer that gets produced at your local brewery.
Well, on that intriguing note, I'm afraid our time is up, but I'm so glad we took at least a couple of minutes to talk about that. And, of course, beyond that, all of the other really important and substantive issues that that we tackled through the course of this interview. Eric Johnson, Assistant Professor of Economics at Carthage, I so appreciate the time you've given me today, and I hope we'll have future conversations on The Morning Show. This was a real treat.
Thank you for having me.
is a test of the State of Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
We're approaching 9 o'clock, and you're listening to WGTD HD Kenosha.